Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Buffalo Bills, maybe next year, a podcast by three friends, none of whom know anything about football, but that's never stopped us before. My name is Scott.
I'm Paul.
I'm Frank. That was a nice, like, you've maybe never heard our podcast before type of intro. It was, like, very accurate.
We have rotating intros. That was one of the more generic ones. We've had terrible, most of them are terrible. That one was the one that was least aggressive in terms of its attempting to be funny and therefore succeeded.
That was the run on first down left tackle.
let's be fair to ourselves. We say most are terrible. That is only if you define most as 98% or more of the time. Solid 2% where we are on cue with our openings.
Yeah. That's definitely true. And folks, if you are joining us for the first time, you've picked the correct time of year to join us because this is the off season. There's no way for the Bills to lose. And that's usually the best time. This is when this podcast shines. We will continue to podcast for a couple of weeks, and then we'll slow down as the off season, you know, kind of goes through the dregs. But you can always find us here making fun of all the stupid things the Bills do, and hoping against hope that they'll somehow figure it out. Speaking of stupid things the Bills do,
easiest segue ever.
Right, that could mean anything. Well, to this podcast.
And since I'm in charge and people are familiar with my anti-Whaley agenda, the first major decision that Doug Whaley took after receiving his contract extension was one of his subordinates saying, "Hey, I'd like to hire my brother who got fired from his most recent job," and him saying, "Yes, let's do that." So, in case you hadn't heard, Doug Whaley did get an extension, the terms of which are not disclosed and consistent with Bill's policy. But our understanding, based on previous reporting, was that it was going to extend through the end of Rex Ryan's deal in 2019 to kind of pair them up. And then shortly thereafter, while they were on the the SS, you know, oil and gas, or whatever Terry Pegula's yacht is named down in Florida. They decided
I think it's Sir Frax-a-Lot. I think that's probably what it is.
It's Fred. It's actually Fred Fraxon after the former running back that he likes so much.
Yeah.
It's mixed feelings for Doug Whaley there.
That's why we had to keep Fred for another couple weeks because he had just named the yacht that. And
exactly.
It was, like,
awkward.
Right.
But anyway, so literally that same Sunday, the news began to trickle out that Rob Ryan, who had previously been involved on a consultant on a kind of game-by-game basis with some really fantastic pictures of him in Bill's uniform, in Bill's gear.
Yeah. That would be incredible, by the way. And I really wish football coaches were like baseball managers and that they would be obligated to wear the uniform during the day because, you know, your short lineman, Rex Ryan and Rob Ryan, as well, could just jog out there. Are the officials going to notice that's a non-rostered person out there? I don't think they will.
Especially with the hair. I mean, Rob Ryan with the locks flowing out. I mean, if Kyle Williams grew his hair out and was a little older, I don't think he would know the difference with all the pads on.
Yep, and the helmet, definitely not.
So Rob Ryan was hired as assistant head coach defense. Unclear what this means for current person in charge of the defense, Dennis Thurman. I guess I have not been up on the news today. Have you guys heard anything more specific on his status?
What I heard was that he could potentially work with the cornerbacks, which I guess was his old position coach job before he became a defensive coordinator.
Since Donnie Henderson, currently our defensive backs coach, or at least formerly our defensive backs coach, has since, I think, interviewed or been hired.
Yeah, he said he's not coming back for sure.
Although it's funny, I don't think on Buffalo, I don't think the Bills have officially released that statement. And what I'm curious about, and Orlando was rabid about this on Twitter, and I don't blame him. But dear God, you guys, help me keep my sanity. Rex just hired his brother's DC, who's been horrible, and fired Henderson. Well, we don't know if that's what's exactly happened. You know, it's possible Henderson said, "I'm out of here. I have a good reputation. Now's the time to, move forward with it." You see Rob coming aboard, you think, "Oh, I'm further down this defensive coordinator ladder." And then there's also rumors that Dennis Thurman, again, is moving into the defensive coordinator role, and Rob will take over the defense, which essentially says to Dennis Thurman, not only were you really just kind of a defensive coordinator in name only, because we all know it's Rex, now you're getting pushed even further down the road in terms of what your impact is on the defense. So I'm interested in seeing. I was kind of hoping, because this came out yesterday, we would know more at this point, but right now we're still kind of in limbo. We just know Rob is on staff, Donnie is likely leaving, and that's it. That's the official status of all we know at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Frank, do you have any thoughts about these moves, at least these series of moves of
I do. Ryan I wanted to yeah. give you the opportunity to completely trash it before I defended it, though.
Oh, yeah, okay, so I'll start. Yeah, I mean, it does, I mean, you know, I don't say that Rob Ryan is necessarily going to be a terrible coach. I mean, I'm sure he's a better defensive coach than I am. But at the same time, you know,
the standard, of course.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, he does not have a particularly thrilling resume. I mean, obviously people are well aware he was fired mid-season from the Saints for having a particularly not very particularly good defense. You can go back and look over his
We're not very historic good means historically awful to that point, yeah, in the season.
Technically, absolutely. And you know, some PMC people would say that, you know, he didn't have a lot of talent on that Saints defense, which is mostly true. But at the same time, you know, Rex Ryan has not had a great amount of talent on his defenses and has gotten them to perform pretty well through, you know, using the scheme, you know, coaching up your players, using good defense, you know, using your line coaches, your linebackers coaches, your defensive back, your position coaches to improve the people who are playing for you and draft them successfully. I know, Henry. I know. My 5-month-old is really.
Where else you can get this kind of Bills analysis, and your host also have his 5-month-old son weeping in the background because he understands what we're saying. That's why he's weeping. In case you're wondering.
I'll make him cry when I crush his opinion. By the way, I take no mercy on Henry that he's 5 months old.
Exactly. So anyway, so I'm gonna get out of the way of Shane Krishnan. I think this move would be bad, even if it wasn't for the fact that. It is the coach hiring his brother to kind of run something that he's supposed to be good at, and I think I would rest on that alone. Frank,
yeah, sure. I think you guys have answered your own question with regards to this. The defensive coordinator on this team is a placeholder, and all he has to do is do what Rex Ryan tells him to do. And so for me, it might as well be a sock puppet just standing there, and his job is basically to organize the defense, not call the defense. You basically need someone there who's going to be in charge of running the practices and doing that kind of stuff, and I'm guessing that he's capable of doing that. He's had a terrible run as a defensive coordinator in Oakland and Dallas and Cleveland and New Orleans. He's had 2 good years where, frankly, if you look at defense, I think that if you look at defense, that it's sort of an accident. Like, you accidentally are good, and then he has a lot of bad years. So I'm not going to defend him as an actual defensive coordinator. I'm going to say he's not actually going to be the defensive coordinator here. He's basically going to be the lunch monitor while, you know, Rex Ryan actually is calling the defense and building the actual defense he wanted to build. And I would say that he was a good linebackers coach. If you look, I think, at his 2000 to 2003 New England Patriots, I think they had some good defenses back then.
I think I would go ahead and stack up Rob Ryan's post-New England 2003 career against other people who were on that New England coaching staff, specifically on the defensive side, mm-hmm. and see which one of those has had better defenses since then. I'd stack up Bill Belichick against Rob Ryan over the last 15 years or so.
Of course you would, but I'm just saying that, you know, like, he had some success doing something. So, for me, he's just largely a placeholder, and it's the guy's brother. I don't know. Like, they're all in this boat together. You're going to live or die by Tyrod Taylor anyway, as far as I'm concerned. And I think Rex Ryan is the guy that you have to be looking at for the control. He's the guy that you have to look at his success with defenses and say, okay, last year was the outlier, and Rob Ryan's not here to fix it. Rob Ryan's here to help Rex Ryan do the Rex Ryan defense. So that's why I'm going to defend it, because I think it's a non-issue.
All right. I mean, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I guess I can't disagree that ultimately whoever it is going to have to deal with Rex Ryan's kind of scheme, you know, a general outlook on things. But it is, to me, you know, if I want to get into the more esoteric kind of psychological realm, as I often do and Frank hates, I would say that if you talk about accountability and, you know, are we going things in the right direction? You know, is this the kind of team that's, you know, win at all costs, or, you know, loyalty to players and to other people is the most important thing. I'm not sure this is quite going to reinforce that message when you have someone like that. But again, I don't know how much that matters to someone who's just getting paid to show up every day. So I don't know. Paul, do you have any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to go back. I think we want to look at the roots of this. We're going to go back to 1799 when, sure. you know, And there was a gentleman who took a role on the Supreme Court. His name was Bushrod Washington. And, you know, he didn't really have, you know, much going for him. You know, he had an undistinguished legal career, a very undistinguished judicial career. You know, and yet, you know, if someone were to have interviewed him on, you know, what he felt, you know, if they criticized him for some of his opinions on this, on, say, McCullough versus Maryland, for example, he might reply to them, hey, you know, might have an interesting opinion on this. My uncle, George effing Washington, that's who. I feel there are subtle displays, and I thank you to America the Book, from whom I got that story, which I remembered from way back when. But, you know, this is such an outward display of nepotism, and again, to bring aboard someone who's very average, and you're bringing them aboard simply for the familiarity of it, and granted, you're going to have a lot of familiarity, they're going to be on the same page as each other, but familiarity, as they say, can breed contempt. I don't know if it will breed contempt in this instance, but it could breed mediocrity, and coming off as a 16th-ranked defense in recent years, this 16th-ranked defense this last year, you know, that's a sign, and then picking up a fired defensive coordinator from a team that was historically bad on defense last year, I'm concerned with it. I know you guys went back and discussed, you know, the more distant history, but I am a more recent history guy, which is the same reason I'm not saying the Bills should sign Joe Montana. You know, just because he was once great at his job doesn't make him great now. So, again, if there's one message to take out of this, it's Bushrod Washington.
I was going to say that Paul is coming out against Joe Montana. I think that's what that sounded like to me.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear.
A thorough repudiation of one of the greatest quarterbacks in NFL history. So, okay.
Right.
Yes.
For shame. For shame, Paul.
Great Saturday Night Live host, though, when he was on. And great quarterback.
That was a wonderful episode. Yes. That was a really good episode.
Because I remember thinking it was 20 years ago, and I watched Bruce Smith just knock him silly in a game that I was attending at Ralph Wilson Stadium, then Rich Stadium, and thinking, this guy's not all that good. And that was 20-some years ago. Now, if I'd seen him 30 years ago, if this were 30 years ago, different discussion. But again, I look at Rob now, and I look at Rex a little bit now, and hopefully I'm wrong, but distressed. Let's see his word, distressed.
We were at the same game, Paul. I remember that game.
Yeah, we were. That was, of course, a good 10 to 12 years before we met. But, yeah.
Yes, okay.
That's
what I think of Rob Ryan.
I will have the last word on this, on the Rex Ryan, Rob Ryan thing, is I do approve of this opening up a series of Parent Trap-esque twins situations where one of them is, you know, supposed to take someone to a dance on like a Saturday night, but then they make another commitment, like they have to coach practice or something, so the other one has to go. I think that's going to be a lot of those kind of shenanigans, which I'm definitely in favor.
Yeah, Taron Killam, Liam Hemsworth SNL sketch.
Exactly. Not particularly good one, yeah.
Right.
So let's continue talking about the coaching staff, if you guys don't mind.
Sure.
I think what we should do is we should kind of take a bit of a round the world of our current coaching staff, or at least some of the more senior people on our coaching staff. But I'm not going to go into Chris Palmer, senior offensive assistant.
It's nice of you to look up his name. Yeah,
I don't know what he does. Or Jason Osvart, strength and conditioning assistant, which is probably just someone who holds the bar while Marcel's lifting. But you know,
what's important job, by the way, because you don't want Marcel dropping in on
exactly. You gotta have a spotter. Gotta have a spotter. Yeah.
Although I think if Marcel dropped weights on his neck, I think the big issue would be you've got to replace that weight that just snapped in half.
Right.
That bar.
Indeed. So let's start with Greg Roman. I mean, he was on record, interestingly enough. I guess someone asked him the question, so how do you want him to answer? But kind of saying like he was surprised that he didn't get a lot of head coaching buzz in this offseason, when last season he did, and arguably, to a certain extent, you could say did a little bit more with less, having a first-time starter, having some injuries at running back, mm-hmm. putting together this line out of nothing to a certain extent. Do you guys feel like you're happy with his performance? And I guess, you know, so as a result, would you be disappointed if he did take another job somewhere else?
I would. I'll go first.
Please.
No problem. So I would say I am somewhat surprised, only because this Bills offense exceeded our expectations, I would say. Maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but they said, oh, Sammy's going to step up this season. We're going to see some of that star potential. Guess what? The last 9 games, find me a better wide receiver in football. Who is... Can you find a better receiver in football the last 9 games of the season? I don't know if you can, and I would be interested in a statistical analysis that showed that. You took Tyrod Taylor, you found a quarterback whose strengths, you know, supported your strengths as a coach. You put him on the field, and here he is, Pro Football Focus's breakthrough player of the year. Not a small honor, no matter how advanced you think Pro Football Focus's metrics are. It's at least good enough to say that there was some serious progress at the quarterback position to the point where we are no longer questioning the position like we used to in the past. A lot of that falls to Greg Roman, not just for utilizing the talent, but not just for, you know, utilizing the talent that he had to perform at standard, but to even perform above the expectation. You got a Pro Bowl season out of LeSean McCoy despite only, what, 12 games played? Mm-hmm. It's the exact opposite position of the defense, in my mind, where you look at a team where you look at a unit whose talents were not best utilized and who underperformed this year. So I am a little bit surprised that Greg Roman is not getting more interest, but at the same time, for a team that could desperately use some continuity somewhere on some side of the ball when something goes right, as it did this season, I'm happy he's sticking around.
Yeah, I'm sort of with Paul. Paul's magic word was continuity, and I think that's the big takeaway for me. Sure, it's obviously a little surprising when you got Doug Marrone getting some dap in the coaching interview process, and Roman's not. I don't think that Greg Roman's offense was exactly what I thought it was going to be. I think that you look at some of the guys they got, and I think you can excuse someone like Percy Harvin from this because he was injured and not really able to play. But, you know, Charles Clay never really materialized, and neither did Jerome Felton. Like, they sort of just vanished, which isn't to say that they didn't do well. And isn't as, you know, I agree everything that Paul said. He managed to get some of the stars managed to flourish in his system, and Tyrod Taylor looks like a very competent quarterback to me. So I think that certainly some of that is on Greg Roman. But I think the bigger thing for me is continuity. You're going to be spending next year rebuilding this defense, and you don't want to also be rebuilding the offense at the same time. When you know, how many times have we done that where there's been turnover and guys have flipped over, and now you have to sort of reinstall a new system, particularly on the offense where you've had, you know, semi-talented quarterbacks that had like some semblance of ability, suddenly have to go through their third or fourth offensive coordinator in 3 or 4 years. I'm ready for that to not be the case.
I mean, I don't want to belabor the point by saying I agree with you guys, so I'll just say I concur, and we will move
on.
Well
done. We use synonyms very well on this podcast.
Yes.
We have talked about Dennis Thurman to a certain extent by saying he's basically just carrying the water for Rex Ryan. Anyone have any strong thoughts beyond that?
No, I mean, I don't know anything about him as a position coach, so I don't have an opinion there on whether it's good to keep him.
Agreed. Danny Crossman, special teams coordinator. If you look at the Football Outsiders special team ranking, the Bills are number 12 in their ranked DVOA, mostly on the strength of kicking game in the sense of
Jordan Gay
and touchbacks, I think, for the most part, because if you look at the weighted field goal extra point, it's in the minus, which is usually not good. And in fact, it's almost entirely on Jordan Gay because kick returns and punt returns are also both negatives. The only one otherwise is positive is punting.
Good dog, Colton Schmidt.
Colton Schmidt.
The Mormon of the future.
His only one job is to do that well, and Colton Schmidt's good at it. So
the Chris Moore of the future.
Yes. Paul, do you have any thoughts on Danny Crossman sticking around or not?
It's such a tough call because this is we've had such an up and down with Crossman. It was two seasons ago we thought he was pulling the city to ship him out of town. The Lions weren't good under him. Get rid of him. Last year, it's like, oh, wow, hey, look at the progress this unit has made under this guy. Oh, I hope even though the coaching staff is changing, let's keep him aboard. And the team did, and Ryan brought aboard all new guys except for Crossman, essentially, as far as the major coaches go, of course. And yet then this year it was right back down to the dumps. So do we blame? I'm more tempted to leave him on the unit, and it's not me saying I have full support of him. It's that I really think they were lacking in returns in terms of the talent that was being used on that squad. I think their coverage suffered by having easily hurt a decent amount of the time, and I think it's tough to blame Crossman for the fact that Dan Carpenter slowly seemed to sink into a mental yeast, if you will, to use the baseball term, from which he could not escape. Where, you know, in the old days, Steve Sachs and Chuck Knoblauch, second baseman, would take routine ground balls and throw them into the third row in baseball games. And I sense the same sort of thing happened to him on extra points this year. So I don't think it's quite fair to pin that all on Crossman. I think the fact that they ranked 12th under less than ideal circumstances with a terrible field goal, a terrible extra point kicking unit this year, which is should be an automatic unit, I give him the benefit of the doubt for at least one more season.
He wasn't the worst at extra points this year. There was actually a kicker who was worse than him on extra points. And if you just look at his field goals, he wasn't awful. Certainly, he got messed up by the new extra point rules. Definitely, that's sort of on him. And my bigger question will be whether there's a better kicker than Dan Carpenter available. But you didn't ask me about the kicker. You asked me about Crossman. And I say cut him loose. I think you can get Bobby April. I think I heard was available, and I always liked his special teams. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, you don't really get credit because Jordan Gay is a good touchback kickoffer. Like, that's it. Like, you don't coach that. He just does that because he's good at it. And so I saw the return game screw up a lot this year, and it wasn't just based on no abilities or bad people returning kicks. It was sort of
there were a lot of fumbles that were critical. I mean, I don't think he can coach people to not fumble other than just saying don't fumble.
I don't know. The Patriots had a whole streak about not fumbling, if I remember right. So
yes, but they cheat, so that's not really fair. They played a couple of times and cheated.
I didn't like the special. I'm saying this. I didn't like the way the special teams played, and I think that there are, as Paul said, it's been a mixed bag the last couple of years, and so if they found somebody else they preferred, I'd be very happy to have somebody else.
Fair enough. I think Paul has kind of convinced me. I think you could put a lot of the success of the unit on individual players, but you could also put the failures of the unit on individual players as well. So I feel like Paul's point about how it was, a year ago there was complaints, I don't know if we can keep Crossman, but we got to get him some new talent. And when he did have the new talent, the unit improved considerably. So I think I'd be willing to let him stick around just for the sake of continuity. Kind of error goes to sticking with the guy you, or even goes to the guy sticking with you have. So
soft.
Yeah, and to put one stat behind, what Scott and I are taking the side of here, it was just the 2014 season, not exactly ages ago, the Bills in the Dallas Morning News special teams poll, which is widely regarded as the poll to go to, or the ranking to go to, is number 2 overall in special teams. So, I'm hesitant to pull a trigger after one middling year, and it wasn't even a bad year, it was a middling year where you had a kicker who was having issues.
Fair enough. So we can move on then, and we will move on to Bobby April III, who is our current linebackers coach.
We need more nepotism, so I go with Frank's point that we hire Bobby April II. Or Bobby April Jr., I guess it would be. I guess people don't go by the second unless they're a king or queen.
Probably. I mean, we'll have to get our heraldry expert on that and report back later. Frank, do you have any thoughts on how the linebackers performed this year?
Let me think. Well, they were obliterated a little, and then they were back. So, I'm not a big fan of how the linebackers played this year. Nigel Bradham took a huge step backwards, and they were probably the softest and worst part of the defense.
Preston Brown, also, a huge step backwards.
Huge step backwards, to the point where these guys might not get money, like the way that they were. It is no longer a concern about whether Nigel Bradham will get a huge contract somewhere in his free agency year. It's a question of whether we want to pay him to try again. Rob Ryan, by the way, decent linebackers coach. I don't know. Maybe not. Had decent years as a linebackers coach. As Scott pointed out, that might have been Bill Belichick as well. But no, the linebackers coach was terrible. He should go.
Okay, Paul.
Yeah, you took a guy who had talent with Preston Brown and made him look like, I can't think of a James Brown, and I mean James Brown now, the dead one. I not the announcer. I mean
classy.
I mean the musician. So. Classy. Well, I had to go with some death. We could talk about Lawrence Phillips later, too, if we want to.
Very good.
But anyway, yeah, it was terrible performance by a talented linebacking core. If your one job is to coach a core, and that core has players who have demonstrated on the field that they can perform well, and they don't perform well, that's on you, and it's accountability. You got to go.
Enough. I agree. I think that's an easy cut. We're gonna call Frank the Turk at this point because he's firing everybody left and right. What does Frank think about Carl Dunbar, our defensive line coach, longtime defensive line coach?
I think you keep Dunbar because I think that the problems with the defensive line were that we had the wrong personnel. Kyle Williams goes down, that sucks. That really messes up a lot of things. And I think that it was pretty clear that Mario Williams wasn't buying into the system. Now, you could say that was his job to make him buy into the system, but I think it's hard to make a guy who's making multi-million dollar, he is like the highest guy paid guy on the team, he's not going to do anything he doesn't want to do. That seems to definitely be Mario Williams' attitude. So for me, I think it was a hard fit, and I think that you, if Ryan is comfortable that he can coach him once they decide not to do this hybrid defense like they did this year, and they just implement the full Ryan defense, if he's okay with Dunbar, then I'm okay with Dunbar.
Yeah, we're now entering a very cautiously, we're tiptoeing the line onto the indifference stage of coaches at this point. So I'm right on that indifference line with Dunbar, and I would say, I'd keep him too, simply because this line will perform well if you put a stool in front of them and tell that stool to coach them. These are just talented guys. Keep the guy they've been listening to for a year in their ear. You know, there wasn't any rapid underperformance save Mario's. So I say stick with Dunbar again. But like I said, I'm on this one. I'm dangerously approaching the meh opinion on this one.
Got it. Okay. And then we'll continue with our... This one is a little more clear-cut in my mind. Kurt Anderson, who was the assistant offensive line coach when Aaron Cromer was out this year, has been hired as the offensive line coach at Brett Bielema's Arkansas program. So he has moved on. However, Aaron Cromer, who is obviously suspended early in the year for some shenanigans.
For beating up a child.
Or bullying a child, any number of ways you could put it. But since then, has been able to put together a fairly decent offensive line that admittedly led the entire league in rushing with some substandard parts. So what do we feel about Aaron Cromer going forward? Why don't we start with Paul?
Yeah, I think when he stopped beating up 16-year-olds, he really turned his season around. So, you know, the fact that the assistant is gone, look at that. Remember, if you listen to our podcast from the beginning of this season, we were railing on the offensive line every week. Oh, Cordy Glenn's not going to get a big contract, so no worries about him. Wood seems to be taking a step back. Well, Incognito's doing pretty well. And then all of a sudden, as the year went on, they gelled. They were able to push the pile forward. There were huge holes in the running game. And granted, if you can give... It's one thing when LeSean McCoy is picking up big yards, when Carlos Williams and Mike Gillisley are picking up yardage in giant chunks. You know, and again, Williams may be something special. I think he could be, but Mike Gillisley is a guy. You know, and while I was impressed with him, and I hope he's on the roster next year, credit goes to the offensive line. They need to improve on their pass protection, but the fact that Cromer only got to hands-on coach this unit for a little over half the season, and that half of the season is when they seem to gel, that I think speaks well for him. So I would want to keep him aboard.
Frank?
The problem is I have a real problem with the fact that he beat up a kid. And the offensive line is a weird place for this because I also had a real problem with Richie Incognito. However, Richie Incognito has played very well and has sort of turned himself into, like, forwardly, like, an apologetic and sort of trying to be a different guy. I haven't seen that from Aaron Cromer, but then again, you don't really talk to the offensive line's coach very much. Yeah. I think that's it's gross because from the outside I want to say no – he was a loser, and that's the last thing I remember about him. But in the spirit of accepting you don't really know people, and even maybe some of the people you know, I will trust the Pegulas to make that decision correctly. And if they're comfortable with him, then I will be comfortable with him for the time being.
So if I put you on the spot and said that you're Doug Whaley and or Rex Ryan, and his contract's up, you're going to resign him then?
Yeah, I'm gonna go talk to Terry and Kim and say, do you have any problems with him being on the team still? How do you feel about him? And if they're okay with him, then I'm okay with him.
All right, that's good. Passing the buck, like to see that. All right.
Well, it's their team.
I agree. I know it's not something to be glossed over. I mean, it's part of the identity of the franchise, and I think for better or worse, you know, when you get sometimes those things go together. I mean, it's not indivisible. He is a good offensive line coach, perhaps. He's also someone who bullies children. Anyway, so...
At least Richie Incognito bullied adults.
Exactly.
So that's a valid
one. Was a woman, and like a much smaller woman, so that's not good.
Agreed. Yeah.
Frank, your job is to bring downerness to this podcast today.
I'm not the downer. The beating up.
I know
people
the people
are the
who
downers.
Committed these the people who committed these crimes are in fact the downers. Again, I will defend them and say they're all better than Lawrence Phillips. That's my argument.
All right. So we got I think just three or four more. I will note that Donnie Henderson is not on the roster on BuffaloBills.com in terms of coaches. So we don't have to do him. We don't have to do any of these things, but we're gonna drive this bit into the ground because god damn it, it's the off season. So Sanjay Lal, wide receivers coach. Paul, go. You're a wide receiver.
I was. Sure. I was for one spectacular season where I caught one ball. So, you know, I was very happy with the progress of the wide receivers generally. I think, you know, Watkins is a talent. And again, I think that's a similar situation to the offensive line. A stool could coach Sammy. But I was very happy to see his development. I did like, generally what I saw of the team this year. I liked it when Harvin was in there. He made a difference. I liked it, and you can clarify this for me, Scott. Hopefully, maybe not. So I'm not putting you on the spot. Was he a wide receivers and tight ends coach, or just the wide receivers?
So Tony Sperano, who I don't believe is the Tony Sperano, but some other Tony Sperano, who is also not Tony Soprano, was the tight ends coach.
Okay, all right. So, you know, I keep the guy. I don't see any reason to change things on offense. So I with the progress of the unit generally, with Salas coming back, I liked him the last couple of weeks. See how he develops. I'm going to go the continuity argument and say you keep Sperano, who is not the Tony Sperano, who is the tight ends coach for the San Francisco 49ers.
Exactly.
Learn something new.
Exactly.
Can you name one wide receiver that did anything well except for Sammy Watkins? Fire him.
Right. There it is. Hey, no, I kind of, to be fair, I think I sympathize with Frank's point. I'm not sure it's enough with a fiable offense, in the sense that I think we learned after the season that Robert Woods was dinged most of the year, torn groin. Chris Hogan also was injured for much of the season, evidently. So
Goodwin missed pretty much the entire season.
So I think I will help out Sanjay Lal by giving him a bit of an incomplete, so to speak, for this year. But he's definitely on the nearer side to getting fired if things go the same way next year, because it is his responsibility to develop depth from players behind him. And although, you know, Marcus Easley caught, I think, didn't Marcus Easley catch a touchdown at some point?
I think he had a career high in receptions this year, which is probably like five, but still.
But still, you know, there needs to be a little more depth there out of the group, finding some of those nuggets out there.
I'm sorry, it was one. But it was a 58-yard touchdown.
You're right, exactly. Yeah, there we
that's go. Why it seemed like five, because that's essentially that's five catches.
You've just five times as yardage.
Consolidated him to one, you know.
Yeah. So then we can go to David Lee, quarterback's coach. Kind of hard to argue with keeping him at this point, right? Or not keeping him, I should say.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if we even need to discuss that. So I'm on board with keeping him on board.
And then Anthony Lynn, whose name's come up as the assistant head coach of note, I'm sure he's a very fine coach. It does have to be said, one wonders if this is a bit of the Rooney Rule coming into effect as to why he's getting a fair amount of interviews as a head coach in other places. But it's also hard to argue with his production with the running backs this year. Anyone have a problem keeping him if he ends up staying?
No, nope. None at all. I
think you look at Gillisley and Williams, and they shown, and that's actually where the real test of his medal is. That it's not LeSean McCoy. It was all the running backs are pretty good.
I couldn't agree with Frank more. I mean, we knew LeSean was going to be good. We didn't when they were cutting Fred, when they were offloading Bryce Brown. We're like, oh, what's going on? Oh, wait, they're 10,000 times better than they were last season. One of the top rushing offenses in the NFL, and you guys have credited the depth behind McCoy that Anthony Lynn helped coach.
Donnie Henderson's not worth talking about because he's not on the coaching staff anymore.
He's gone.
So that leaves us with the other Tony Sperano, who is began his coaching career in the UFL with the Hartford Colonials.
Ah.
Their assistant defensive line coach. So your Connecticut sports team, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you Connecticutians out there, I'm sure we've all been following the Colonials closely and are sad to miss Tony Sperano. Do people feel confident about him going forward, given what's going on with Charles Clay this year?
Wow. I think Frank and I were both hoping for the other to give some great insight into that question, because I'm not sure exactly what the heck I want to say on this one.
I don't know what happened to Charles Clay this year, and I don't know whether I don't know how much of that was the scheme and getting Taylor acclimated to how the game was going to be played and kind of having to – he disappeared. I mean, there has to be – it has to be some on Clay, and I don't, and he's a veteran too on some level. So for me, like, that's almost not even coaching anymore. That was like, it wasn't like he was undisciplined or he was a young guy who didn't learn. It was kind of like what happened to Charles Clay. So I don't know if I want to pin that on the coach.
You know, I'm okay with Clay's. You can look and say, wow, fewest catches he's had since 2012, when he was only starting 9 games. He also played the fewest games he's played since then. He had some huge performances. You know, his yards per catch was exactly where it's been. He still produced the same number of touchdowns he always has, and he was battling injury a lot of the season. So, but I think, again, this is where I'm going to take the argument Frank and I used for the running backs coach and say, but what's going on behind Charles Clay? Greg had some moments, but when you're using Cyrus Quanjo as a tight end for the last 2 games, you have not developed your depth very well at that position.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree. I'd say that the one bright spot for him is I feel like Chris Gregg maybe got a little more involved.
He did,
this season.
I would say Gregg played better. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And in that sense, I think that would be one of the signs of coaching, in the sense that, again, with Charles Clay, you're kind of getting the finished product. You know, if he gets the ball or he doesn't get the ball, that's on the coordinator, that's on the scheme, that's on the quarterback, and it's also on who's open and, you know, everything else. But I think Greg's reliability and improved kind of play has I think that pushes the former Hartford Colonial defensive line coach into the retain ranks for now. So that is pretty much it. We won't need to go into Hal Luther, assistant strength and conditioning, or Dan Libbard, strength and conditioning assistant.
I don't know. I think Chris Hogan's biceps were looking good this year.
That's okay. That's good. I like to hear it. Jason Vrabel, offensive quality control. I don't know if any relation to Mike on that one. But yeah, so I think with that, we will get to our discussion of the playoffs, I think, in a little bit. But for now, Paul, do you have a This Day in Bills history?
I do indeed have a This Day in Bills history, and I don't think they're related because I think Vrabel is spelled differently. So I have nothing to prove that, but if anyone zones out during this, feel free to look it up. So.
Good man.
We're going to go back 25 years. Bills' first ever Super Bowl season. They played a very key playoff game against the Miami Dolphins at Ralph Wilson Stadium. It was their first playoff game of their run to the Super Bowl. It took place in front of 77,000 at the stadium. So now I'm just going into the general details. And, of course, this is a good time for my throat to get clogged. But I will persist through this, just like the Bills' offense persisted through snowy weather, where the teams combined to have the highest scoring non-overtime game in playoff history. The snow was just falling nonstop all afternoon. Jim Kelly had missed the last 2 regular season games, had a brilliant game. Reed and Lofton also had great games. It was really just a great back and forth. The Bills took the opening kickoff, and on the first play, Kelly hit Reed for 20. There was a Thomas fumble. Mikel recovered, but bam, Reed beats Oliver for a 40-yard TD. That set the pace. My biggest memory of this game is the Miami Dolphins offensive lineman, whose name I'm going to have to look up. It's Roy Foster. I don't have to look it up because I'm that smart. But catches a pass, I think, at the Dolphins within either 3 or 7 late in the game, and did this bizarre dance. It was a 4th and 5 play. Or no, excuse me, a 3rd and goal play. He did this bizarre dance where he, like, shook the ball like he was trying to wake it up. I can't even describe it. I hope you can find a highlight somewhere. But that is my most pressing memory of this game. But the Dolphins were never able to close the gap any further. Hal Gardner, a special teams ace, forced Mark Logan to fumble the ensuing kickoff. Scott Norwood with the recovery 2 weeks before the worst day of his life. Andre Reed got open for a 26-yard TD. That was all she wrote. You know, there are a good bevy of quotes on this game, and it well-timed when we did the podcast today, because kudos to the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, who's covered the Bills' first Super Bowl season and has some great quotes on this game that I encourage you to read. They're my primary source this week when compiling information. But, you know, Andre Reed noted we'd seen it on film all week, that Oliver would be covering Andre Reed in a 3-receiver set. They knew they could exploit it. They were just, you know, highly confident that they could do everything they wanted against this Miami defense, and they proved it true in January of 1991, beating the Dolphins 44-34. Now, as many of you know, or for new listeners, we always have a quiz question that goes forward on this one. So there are there's so many potential good ones I could go with here. Do we want to focus on a Bill or on a Dolphin? What's everyone in the mood for?
I feel like we should focus on a Bill, but
I think you're right, because I just realized the Dolphin I was thinking of, he's been an answer in trivia before. So we're going to go the other direction entirely.
Okay.
So this Bills player produced an interesting stat in this game. Not that interesting, but he had one kick return for 14 yards. However, he was not a kick returner. In fact, if there was one thing he was known for, it was for four straight seasons of catching nothing but touchdown passes. Who is this Buffalo Bill?
Say that again?
He is a non-kick returner who returned a kick for 14 yards, probably a pooch kick, I was guessing. I can't remember in that much detail.
Okay.
He was known primarily for only catching touchdown passes for four straight seasons. He had two catches in 87, two touchdowns, two catches in 88, two touchdowns, one catch in 89, one touchdown, three catches in 90, three touchdowns. And then he ended in 91 when the last game of the regular season, he had to catch a pass from Frank Reich for like 5 yards that ruined his streak.
Fascinating. And I think Paul always does a great job in picking out these trivia questions, because again, it's not something that you could like Google quickly to find the answer to. And I don't Google things. I don't, because I have a basically a perfect streak in terms of getting these correct. So Frank, do you want to take a guess first, or do you want to let me and go off what I say? I mean, it's either way.
I'm struggling because I don't know. I mean, I'm. Jamie Mueller was around then. I don't know. He's more of a tight end, though. He was running back. What am I saying?
He's a fullback.
Yeah,
and he was on the Bills roster during this time. So yeah. I'm letting you know, no matter whether your guess is right or wrong, it's not moronic, so you can have confidence in that.
Okay. I'm going to go with Kenny Davis. I think Kenny Davis was on the team, and I think he fits the role.
Interesting. Okay, that is a good guess, Frank. I will say, the answer is William Cale. I mean, you guys knew him as Ray Cale. He did catch all those touchdowns for us in the late 80s and early 90s. What you may not know is that he was born in Usk, Wales, in 1922, and he played for Welsh rugby leagues in the late 40s and early 50s. And at the time they called him a rampaging, tough tackling flanker. And he, Wales, big rugby powerhouse. He unfortunately died in 2006 at the age of 83. I think it speaks a lot to the toughness of rugby players when you think he was well over 65 years old when he caught those touchdowns.
69 years old, I believe, when he did that.
It's
remarkable.
His age is one of the top players for St. Helens. Was where, you know, long behind him, his appearance in the Lancashire Cup was nearly 40 years behind him at that point.
Yeah, no, I mean, and again, he played in all those Five Nations matches. Those times where he was with Pontypool RFC, I mean, I think we all remember those days. But it's nice to see him have those Bills uniforms, get those touchdowns. He's a good blocker, too. And it wasn't just, obviously, as Paul pointed out, not just a receiver, but really his blocking was really why he was on the team. So can't argue with Ray Cale.
Right. We will argue with Ray Cale, but we're going to like it as an answer anyway. We'll say that answer is co-correct. It is Ray Cale as well as tight end Butch Roll.
Butch Roll. Okay.
Yep, so if you remember...
Rick Roll?
But yes, you have been Butch Rolled, which is worse than being Rick Rolled. Trust me. No one wants to be Butch Rolled. I think I read recently, and I'm actually now I'm going to cheat and look at Google, but I think he's like a male model now, isn't he? I don't know why I'm asking you guys. Oh, yeah, he's like a bodybuilder. If you're into large, muscular men, we don't judge. You know, Google Butch Roll, check him out online. This guy is in shape, even though he's now 51 years old. So kudos to Butch Roll. And he was great at catching touchdowns.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why you come to Buffalo Bills maybe next year for all sorts of male modeling talk and rugby talk and occasionally some football talk.
Right. And I did look up Roy Foster's dance, and they have an article about it, but I've yet to see any photo of this. So I will keep looking to see if I can find a photo or video of Roy Foster dancing.
We'll put it on the Facebook page, facebook.com/BBillsMNY, if Paul can find it.
Yep.
With that, I think we have a whole off season to talk about everything. Does anyone have anything else that's current Bills focus that they want to talk about before we get to our playoff kind of denouement?
Yeah, there was kind of a big league week, so I think we can move on to playoff.
Yeah, we can do that. I have all my homework that we had in that email written out, so that when we get to those topics.
we have a whole off season's worth of topics. In fact, I found another one. I'll just tease it for the fans right now. Buffalo Bills on the website has a photo gallery of Tyrod Taylor's best looks of 2015. And he has got some fantastic outfits. And I think we're definitely just going to rank those at some point in the podcast. But not tonight, because I want to give you guys some chance to everyone to sit and ruminate on it, and we'll have to have a whole thing and we'll have some fun with it. But anyway, I watched a fair amount of the games this weekend. I feel like the Houston Chiefs game was the least interesting of them because it was a complete domination, and I think most of us actually ended up picking Houston for some reason.
I got all the picks wrong, I'm pretty sure.
I've got to go back and listen. Did I pick Houston? What was I thinking? If so,
I think we're all really dumb, seeing as how we beat the Texans and lost to the Chiefs, and somehow we figured out that the Texans are at home, so they'll win.
No, I just didn't believe the Chiefs were going to win a 12th game in a row. Like that's the entire.
I think that's a fair point, but I think everyone was convinced of that fact soon after Brian Hoyer threw his third interception in the first half. I think it's kind of clear that was not good.
Would you rather have Brian Hoyer or EJ Manuel as your backup quarterback?
EJ.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
He's not the worst quarterback. Brian Hoyer was so – I was rooting for him just to score once because I felt so bad. He embarrassed himself. Like, good for him. Like, he just got right back up, went right back out there, and, did it again.
Yep, it's the Chumbawamba approach.
It was the absolute worst performance by a quarterback I've ever seen in my life.
He's a Michigan State guy, so I have no problems with him failing miserably on a national stage. Paul, anything else on this game?
No, this is a game I watched the least for obvious reasons. I think the games were largely a bell curve where crap, awesome, awesome, crap. So that's my sense. So we'll move on to the next one.
Yeah, so the next game was the Steelers and the Bengals with A.J. McCarron in for the Red Rifle. I think I was honestly, the biggest disappointing thing about this game was that Dalton wasn't in because, frankly, I mean, Roethlisberger getting hurt, I mean, obviously, you can say whatever you want about his history, but certainly the fact that he, getting hurt at the end of the game, them kind of collapsing, I have no idea how this team's going to be able to put up any fight at all against, I think they're going to Denver, right?
Yeah, they're going to Denver.
Yeah, whereas if you have Cincinnati in there, I feel like with Dalton healthy, I feel like Cincinnati can take the Patriots. And that's basically all of my playoff rooting scenarios at this point are who can beat the Patriots. Mm-hmm. And removing the Dalton-led Bengals from the equation, I think he could have come back next week. Would have been really great if the Bengals had finished this game. I stopped watching about halfway through, so I did not see the end of game.
Oh, my God, wow. Scott. Oh,
I heard
I
heard
I missed
stuff.
The first half of the game because my wife and I had rented, not rented, we checked out of the library, the fantastic classic, as you know, Gremlins. So we watched that, and then there you go. Gizmo was on the podcast. Boy, but what a... what was funny on Twitter is at the beginning of the fourth quarter, toward the end of the third quarter, everyone was just saying, boy, since he really blew it this chance, I'm like, what are you talking about? It's a 15-point game going into the fourth. Like, that is overcome all the time. And sure enough, they overcame it. And then someone else noted on Twitter, like, if Burfict had made that interception and run into the locker room and just stayed there, the Bengals probably win because he came back on the field. He did stupid things, and the Bengals ended up losing this game.
They won that game, guys. The interception with less than 2 minutes, it was over. The game was over. If they had taken a knee three times, they would have kicked a field goal and won the game. If they had had a little conversation with themselves where they said, all right, let's really focus on not fumbling, they would have won the game. If they had at any point not given the Steelers 40 extra yards, they would have won the game. It was insane. The game was a fucking meltdown. If you believed that the NFL was biased against certain franchises, you would absolutely believe the fix was in, because it was ridiculous, the series of events that happened over the last 2 minutes. The only other thing about that is the indignation from the announcers, and certainly it was like a gross display at the end of football, the end. But it's not, it's far from, like, I wouldn't say it's commonplace, but I'd say a couple times a season, games get that ugly, and hits get that ugly, and it was just because it was on a national stage that they were really sort of like acting as if it was some sort of super terrible situation. Some of those hits are part and parcel of AFC North football throughout the year. So for me, I wanted to dig the announcers in the NFL for sort of acting like, oh my God, I can't believe our product is this violent and we don't like this. It's like, that's exactly what your product is. And also, that was an insane, I had to explain to my wife how that game ended, and the next day when she woke up, and it took her a while to grasp like the fullness of the bed shitting that the Bengals did. Marvin Lewis won the game, and he's never won a playoff game, and he still didn't win. So,
yeah,
anyway,
I did not see it, so I can't speak too much to exactly what was going on. But yes, it is obviously quite the game. So we will go to the next game, which was boy, if you're a Bills fan, yeah, this game had everything that you wanted in it, except for a happy ending for a fellow traveler on the road of NFL kind of. Mediocrity / cursedness / just kind of fans that are a little beat up over time. The Minnesota Vikings doing all they could to play their game, you know, a run-first defensive game, put your quarterback in a position to win, play great defense, do some great stuff against Russell Wilson and keep the Seattle offense under control. And then late at the end, suddenly the wheels slowly kind of start to come off. There's, you know, the Adrian Peterson fumble, you know, when he didn't have a great game, and then all of a sudden he fumbles and kind of puts the nail in the coffin after Seattle, you know, was, you know, they snapped the ball over Russell Wilson's head, for crying out loud, and then Russell Wilson picks it up, finds a guy who's open, and he runs 45 yards to make Seattle's biggest play of the day, put him in range for a touchdown. They get the field goal after the fumble the next play, and then you get down to the Vikings do everything that they need to do to close that game out, except send Blair Walsh out there with a guy who could turn the freaking laces in.
Oh my Lord, he's that was. Does anyone else just want to fly to Minnesota and give Blair Walsh a hug? They're actually first graders writing letters to Blair Walsh saying it's okay, man. Like that's the misfortune that comes to, and that poor guy. And again, those. The Vikings, I almost shed a tear watching their game plan. It was so brilliant watching this been wiped the floor with by the Seahawks earlier this season, put together this perfect game plan that, you know, allowed them to move the ball on offense. They just couldn't finish. And then to keep Seattle off the board on the defensive side of the ball, it was really just a spectacle to watch. For them to come out of that with a loss because of some crippling mistakes at the end and some, you know, bad luck and just bad clutch performance. It was tough to watch, and I really feel like, just like Frank mentioned with Cincinnati deserving to win the Pittsburgh game, I think the Vikings really deserve to win that game, and it would be funny because now I wouldn't be surprised if Seattle goes all the way, and yet they could very well be done switch the other way.
Talk and you know, just on the heels of the game the night before, a team that absolutely shits the bed to lose the game, Minnesota does the same thing. The other thing to point out, Blair Walsh had all the points in the game for Minnesota. It wasn't like, so it's terrible that he becomes the GOAT, because at the end of the day, he scored the other 9 points in the game, so he was the only one really sort of producing all day, and, you know, he misses one because the laces are in. He says himself, like, it doesn't matter, the laces are in, I should put that in, and he didn't put it in. You feel for the guy, you got to make that kick even with the laces in, but, I mean, what are you going to do other than just sort of shake your head and say, good God. Anyway. And then my favorite game of the day, Scott. My favorite
game
of the day.
Yes. I mean, the Redskins-Packers game. I have a friend at work who's a she's a girl. So she is doesn't
woman.
Understand. Yeah.
We are now at the age where women will speak to us.
Mm. Yeah. And she's a lovely person. But she is actually a Packers and Redskins fan. And I've attempted to explain to her on many occasions.
Can't do that.
That you can't do that. That's bigamy. That's not allowed. And then this Sunday, she kind of paid the price for it and was forced to pick between her children, and she did pick the correct team. That is, of course, the Packers, who started slow, but were able to contain Kirk Cousins, who at this point, I'm running out of reasons to think that he's not a good quarterback, because he actually played almost as well as you could possibly play in a 17-point loss or whatever it ended up being. Because really the rest of the team just kind of did not give him much help at all. The Packers suddenly found their mojo with a little bit of hurry up, a little bit of Aaron Rodgers, just kind of keeping the Redskins defense off balance with some, both with tempo, but also with snapping the ball, with the Redskins having 12 guys on the field. Really a couple critical plays, because for a while there, the Redskins were up a lot and the Packers looked like they were dead in the water. But, you know, it's, if you were picking that game, you pick the Packers because of experience and because of Aaron Rodgers, and that's what it got it done. Because coming in, the Redskins were playing much better, but that's not how it ended.
Yeah, Washington sucks, and they can pick the big one.
I was wondering what Frank's take on it would be. I was, you know, Cousins played well. It wasn't on him. I think the Packers, for as much as they struggled at the end of the season, for Washington, as much as they turned it on after that ugly Monday night loss to Dallas in early December, the better team tends to win these types of games. And sure enough, it happened, and I think the Packers were a better team. I think they're probably done next week. We'll get into that in a second. But, that was all this game was to me.
To be nice, I will say Washington definitely took advantage of a down year in their conference and in their division, and they made the most of it, and good for them on that. But they're very much an incomplete team, and that was kind of what to expect against a Green Bay team that finally found its groove. So, you know, the moment they had to play somebody who was, you know, good, they lost. And you know what? That's Buffalo. If Buffalo is in the NFC, maybe they win the NFC East or a similar type situation, and they get bounced in the first round because they have kind of some things going their way in the other. So the good news for Washington is this is a good place for them to start next year, if I'm being nice and generous. But as far as I'm concerned, they suck, and they can bite the big one.
I have a question for Frank, which came up on Sunday. It's the Super Bowl, New England Patriots versus Washington Redskins. Who do you root for?
Oh, my God, baseball. I'm rooting for baseball. I think
I'm taking the proverbial gun.
Hold on. Is Tom Brady, like, it's still like the Tom Brady Bill Belichick?
Yes. There's no major injuries or anything.
Then you know what? I'm actually at this point, I'm rooting for them because I know what that's like, and I don't want to live in a city full of not happy Washington fans, but like insanely smug Washington fans. And so for me at this point, the devil I know, I'm rooting for New England.
But yeah, I mean, they're going to rub it in for us as Bills fans for years anyway. They're going to be terrible for the next 20 years. So what's the big deal if they win 5 versus 4?
Right, if they win 10 Worlds or 10 Super Bowls, like, is it going to be any worse, really? Like, no, of course not. Like, so
I think that is interesting. I mean, I think it would feel like it would be a different answer if one of us was living in Akron or, you know, somewhere else, Omaha.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay, so we will then move on to next week's matchups.
Good English.
Yeah. And it will start Saturday with your Kansas City Chiefs visiting said New England Patriots at 4:30. I do not have the lines on this game, but I will look them up now.
I will never pick against New England because every time I do, they win. And so it's not that I don't think the Chiefs can't beat New England. I'm just going to pick New England, and then if Kansas City wins, I'll be happy.
Yeah, I think I'm going to pick New England on this one as well. And again, if I picked against the Chiefs last week, I feel dumb because why would I do that? But I might have. I think I'll pick against them again, though, because the Patriots. That is my logic on this one. They don't lose at home in the divisional round of the playoffs. Usually or when they do, it's to Baltimore. So I really think it's going to be a Patriots victory.
Yeah, I think you know, I will ask this question then. Do you see a theory of victory for the Chiefs? Do you see a way that they win this game?
Absolutely. They have talent. They've got capability. They won 12 in a row. If you can win 12 in a row, you can probably beat anyone in the league. I just don't feel today is going to be their day to do that with New England.
I think New England towards the end of the year finally was beat up enough that like they were struggling offensively and whatnot. And I think that's some of what I think that's some of what how they would win, is that they would be able to play good enough defense and frustrate Brady. And I think that's their theory of victory.
Okay. Yeah. No. I mean, I agree. I mean, I think I can see how Carolina or how Kansas City can win the game. I do agree that it probably is just not going to happen, though. I think also the Patriots cheat, and their ability to cheat at home is significantly improved. So I will say that that aids their cheating and therefore their chances of winning. And so yeah, I will think that the Patriots win. If you look at the next game, I was looking
Cardinals
for the
Packers.
The Cardinals Packers game. Thank you, Paul.
No problem.
I still do not have the odds, so why don't you go ahead and talk about that, Paul?
Sure. So this I think is going to be a very good game. I think it's going to be a lot like last Saturday night's games. Yeah, I think it's going to be the offensive version of that. I think we're going to have a lot of fireworks for a while. I think we're going to have two just solid teams, not much of a rivalry built up, which is what makes it even more interesting, but I think this is how a rivalry can start. I think it's going to be back and forth. I think the Packers are going to step it up a notch in the playoffs. I think the Cardinals are new to this, even though you can talk about them going to the Super Bowl just a few years ago and being more of a perennial playoff team the last couple seasons, and then, of course, just missing the year before than they have been. So they're a good team. But I think Rodgers is ready to lead this team on their own. I'm going to – and if you'd asked me this 30 seconds ago, I would have picked differently. But I'm going to go with the Packers now.
Interesting. And you would definitely be disagreeing with Vegas, who has this as the biggest line of the weekend with the Cardinals as an 8-point favorite.
Oh, wow.
Frank, how do you feel about the Packers-Cardinals?
I'm going to go with Vegas here, and it's only because I know nothing about the Arizona Cardinals other than they're a very good football team. So I think I know that Green Bay struggled towards the end of the year offensively, and they certainly found their groove last week, but I think they found their groove against Washington, and that's different than finding it against a team that won its division in the West. And so my very uninformed opinion will be that Arizona will win the football game.
I have to agree with Frank in the sense that I have not seen the Cardinals play a lot this year, not having played anyone really that the Bills are played or uh-huh. Bills playing them. Obviously, I did see the Packers. I do think I kind of agree with Frank's pick and his logic behind it, in the sense that I don't know what to make of this game. So I will just say the Cardinals, sure. And then we will move on, and we'll have everyone pick against the spread now, just because I feel like it. And it makes it a little more interesting. And we will say the Seahawks, who are 3-point underdogs, go on the road to face the number one Carolina Panthers, the 15-1 Carolina Panthers. Does anyone see the Seahawks winning / covering this game?
I see them covering, and I actually see them winning. I think Panthers did beat up on a lot of mediocre opponents. That doesn't make them a bad team at all. They're 15-1 for a reason. Very reminiscent of me to the Pittsburgh team that finished 15-1 in 2004 that knocked the Bills out of the playoffs with their backups, then should have lost to the Jets, but had the fortune of the Jets missing easy field goals over and over, survived the Jets in overtime, then went on to be beaten by a clearly superior Patriots team. I think the Panthers are a very good team. I think they're on the rise. I don't think they're at a 15-1 level, and I do think the Seahawks have laid their egg, and that was last week, and they escaped. And I would expect them to cover the spread and then beat the Panthers.
I'm pulling for the Panthers here. I like anybody.
Yes, that's my answer as well. I am pulling for them, don't get me wrong, but my logic is saying Seahawks.
I think you get to 15-1 by being a really good football team, and even if you're beating up on mediocre teams, I think Cam Newton is amazing. I like how Cam Newton is playing and has been playing, and I'm glad that he has a team that's sort of keeping up with him now. And I am just going to pick the Panthers because I want to pick the Panthers, and so they're going to cover and they're going to win, and Cam Newton's going to go nutty, and Russell is going to suck because he went to Wisconsin or something.
There you go. Yeah, so everyone knows who I'm rooting for in this game because there are not just Russell, but there are other Wisconsin ties on the Seahawks. But this one's tough. I mean, I think the Panthers are a very good team. I think Seattle has been there. I think you have to look, though, and the Panthers have been there, too. The Panthers were right there last year on some of these. Was it last year or 2 years ago that they lost in the very end of the game in the playoffs? And so I think this year might be the year that they get over the hump. So I'll take the Panthers in a close one. I could see the Seahawks covering, but I would definitely take them if you were betting. But I could definitely see Carolina winning too. And then your football playoff weekend, your last four game weekend of the NFL season, is the Steelers at the Broncos, who are 6.5-point favorites. Why don't we start with Frank?
I think the Steelers are going to win this game. I think they're going to start playing with Peyton Manning, and my worry is that Peyton Manning's not really that good. You know what? I take this back. I'm going to pick the Broncos because I just remembered how hurt Ben Roethlisberger is. Oh, wait, no. I'm going to pick the Steelers because every time I think that Ben Roethlisberger is hurt beyond repair, he comes out and throws for 600 yards and wins a football game. So the answer is I am going to pick the Broncos.
Oh, what's our spread again, Scott?
It's 6.5 for your Denver Broncos.
Yeah. I'm going to say the Broncos win. I'm going to say the Steelers cover. I think it's going to be a close game. I think there's injuries back and forth. I think Denver, you take out the quarterback position, I think Denver's a better team, and they have home field, and the quarterback position is a mess right now for both squads based on the injuries. So I'm going to say Steelers cover, Broncos win.
I think I'll take the Broncos to cover. I think it's going to be a problem for the Broncos that Peyton Manning is going to attempt to play, or at least is not healthy, I should say. That Peyton Manning's not like 30 years old. That's going to be a problem for them. I'd be very concerned if I were them playing the Patriots, even if they are at home next Sunday. But I think in this game that the Steelers' defense does not scare me enough to the point where I'd be worried about Ben Peyton Manning getting hurt, so I will stick with the Broncos to get it done between defense and a little bit of Peyton Manning to get them over the hump. Do we want to talk about relocation at all? I think that's the other big story that the NFL successfully timed to land the day after one of the great college football games of all time and the day before or the day of the State of the Union address.
Kind of during the State of the Union, yeah.
That they were sneaking two teams out of their states into Los Angeles. I mean,
potentially sneaking one for sure.
Yeah. Does anyone, obviously we all feel terrible for the Rams and potentially the Cardinals as well.
And that's what is really an interesting discussion. I think this could be one we kind of book for next week once we know a little bit more about the situation, but I will give my initial thoughts. Is this is such an interesting scenario because I've been reading some of the Rams blogs, and there are just as many people who are like, oh, I hate this, our owner sucks, we're leaving St. Louis, how do we do this? Is there are people who stayed with the team the 21 years since they left Los Angeles when they were the Los Angeles Rams saying, hey, I feel for all you in St. Louis, we know what this is like, but I'm really happy to be able to have season tickets next year and go to all the games. So this is certainly an interesting scenario, and I don't want to necessarily give a rapid reaction just because there are so many different things about this move, but I think we definitely should table this, discuss this more next week.
Definitely.
I think so, because I think there's quite a bit to talk about. They certainly moved St. Louis in part to not have to do a major realignment, which would have been necessary if they moved Oakland, I think San Diego was always going to be the add-on team, and I think that if you moved Oakland, there was a lot of considerations about having to switch one of those teams to the NFC, because you can't have two AFC teams in the same, the TV deals won't work, and then all of a sudden you've got to like move everything around. St. Louis is sort of like in the center of the country, but playing in the West anyway, so it makes sense on a lot of levels from that regard. I would say that the most interesting thing that I saw in the reports about this is that the city of St. Louis and the county and the state of Missouri collectively still owe about $144 million on the Rams Stadium. And so that is something to keep in mind as we head into Buffalo Bills building a stadium season, which is sooner than you think it is, and the scourge of public money being used for private enterprises who then decide to just leave town and stick you with a stadium that you can't use for $144 million left over. But I have many more thoughts than that about it, and like you say, we're kind of running up on the end here. But
I think that's a good start, and we'll have some more thoughts, more takes for you next week. We will also probably, I think what I will do is I will post on Facebook for those of you who tracked earlier in the year. We did a little bit of a confidence index about how we feel about the team earlier this year, and I feel like now would be a good time to do it. Admittedly, it would be great to do it before we hired this Rob Ryan kind of fiasco. At least I'm going to call it a fiasco. But it'd be interesting to see what the fans have to say, and we'll have more fan comments and questions to talk about next week. We didn't get a chance to put out a call this week because we were it's the off season and we're not as good as our jobs. Which, of course, we're not getting paid for. So, anyway, if you would like to get in contact with us, you can go to the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/bevillesmny. I will usually try and post some things on there. I was trying to think of what to say to Bills fans watching that Vikings game on Sunday, but I was kind of like, we've been down this road. We know what it feels like. It has been a while since it's been in the playoffs, but we know what it feels like to lose on a gimme kick. So you can also join us on Twitter. Paul, are you going to be doing any tweeting?
I'll definitely be tweeting a bit during the games. I did during the Bengals-Steelers game. I don't know which game. I don't know when. I am like the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. You have no idea, but it will happen at some point. Except you will know it's going to happen this weekend, which who knows if Jesus is coming back or if Christianity is real. I don't know.
If Jesus is coming back... If Jesus is coming back this weekend, Paul will be tweeting about it.
I will be. I'll like, up. Oh, I'm screwed.
Okay, yeah, but not from the official account. Like, do it from your account, okay?
I don't have my own account. I tweet with my wife from BBillsMNY. That is legit. We talk about Scrabble on my BBillsMNY account.
That explains a lot, okay?
So for Scrabble tips or thoughts on football, be sure to follow at BBillsMNY.
Absolutely.
You can email us at BBillsMNY@gmail.com, which we check occasionally. You can go to our WordPress site. What is it, Frank?
I know it's dbillsmny.wordpress.com. And while I'm thinking of it, because we should write an article, we should be fishing. We mentioned this before the show started. We should be fishing to try and get as many St. Louis fans to listen to us and be Bills fans as we can.
That's true.
Maybe next week, everybody who's listening to us should go out and reach out to St. Louis people.
Find
a Rams fan. Tell them to tune in. We're going to make our best pitch next week why you should be a Bills fan instead of a Rams fan.
Agreed. And then if you also want to contact us, you should send a letter to P.O. Box 90820. I don't
know. Fiverr. Yep.
Niner.
Throw a niner in there.
But that's pretty much it. We will be back next week, and until then,
it's Albuquerque, by the way, PO Box 90820. So
Albuquerque, Missouri.
Yes.
So until next week, I'm Scott.
I'm Paul.
I'm Frank.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.